You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay, how's that? Better? No? Should be.
Hello?
Okay. All right, let's actually try to have one of these podcasts get recorded for once. That would be nice. Okay, so how far did we get on Monday? We started looking at dimensionality reduction, which is what we're doing for the rest of the class today, and there were kind of three dimensions to dimensionality reduction. We got as far as covering PCA. We just got on to the first case where PCA might break in some subtle way, which is going to bring us on to clustering, which we'll talk about today. And third, we're going to move on to community detection, which is something like the analogous approach to clustering when you're dealing with networks or relationships rather than just raw features. But in all of these cases, our basic goal is to somehow compactly describe high-dimensional data using a small number of dimensions. So I think the most intuitive way to grasp this concept is to think about it as something like a compression algorithm. What I mean when I say we want to describe the data compactly is that we want to take our high-dimensional data, compress it into a low number of dimensions without losing too much information, so that we'd be able to recover the original data as accurately as possible if we wanted to. And to do so, we're making this basic assumption that says our data approximately lies on some low-dimensional manifold. Whatever a low-dimensional manifold is could mean something like a small number of dimensions that capture our opinions, a small number of topics in documents, or a small number of communities in a network, which is what we'll see later today. So really, on Monday, we spent pretty much the whole class introducing PCA. So here we have some high-dimensional data, in this case, two dimensions, and we're saying, can we compress it? Are there some dimensions we can throw away without losing too much information? And can we find those informations that we should keep such that as much information as possible is preserved? So in the case of this kind of data, it's going to be something very simple. We want to find the line that approximately goes through the data. It's going to look something like this, and that kind of corresponds to a new set of bases for the data. So you'd be able to re-represent the data like this, such that if all you keep is the position of the data point along this line, that preserves almost all of the information. You can throw away the distance from this point without having lost too much. Of course, any of this only becomes interesting once you have something like 1,000-dimensional data where you want to find 10 dimensions rather than 2-dimensional data where you want to find one. But 2-dimensional data happens to be easier to draw. Okay? So the point is, once you've found this basis, then you can discard the low variance dimensions and keep the high ones. And essentially what we're doing in the last lecture is to prove that if you want to discard low variance dimensions and keep high variance dimensions, then the PCA is the best possible thing to do in terms of the MSE. So it's going to give you the best possible compression you can get by throwing out dimensions. Is going to be found by taking whatever these eigenvectors of the covariance matrix. That's going to give you the best possible solution in terms of the mean squared error, so in terms of this sort of reconstruction cost, or in terms of how much information we've lost. Okay, that's as far as we got on Monday. And I teased you with this idea that PCA may not be the be-all and end-all of all dimensionality reduction algorithms by saying, what is it going to do if your data looks like this? So it doesn't quite exhibit the same property as the data set from the previous slide. It's not really possible to draw some axes through this data such that most of the variance lies in one direction and very little variance lies in the other. Whatever basis you want to put this data on, it's going to be equally bad. You're going to be throwing out a lot of information if you were to just discard one of the dimensions. PCA is not going to do much. You have about equal variance in all the dimensions. If you ran PCA on this, discarded a dimension, you're going to lose half the information no matter what you try and do. So you're out of luck. But, you know, I said we want to apply dimensionality reduction whenever there is low-dimensional structure in our data, whatever low-dimensional structure means. So having lots of variance in a few dimensions and a little bit of variance in a lot of dimensions, that's one notion of low-dimensional structure. That's the kind of low-dimensional structure that PCA finds, but it's not all there is. So another notion is that the data could be highly clustered, or otherwise it could be highly localized or something like that. In this case, we can find some clusters in this data set. And intuitively what we can say then is if I just replaced each node by its cluster membership, if I tell you what cluster a node belongs to, then you can pretty much reproduce this data set. I just say, look, there's four clusters. They're centered about these four points. If you want to compress this, just replace every one of these data points by the center of the cluster it belongs to. You won't have moved it too far. You won't have lost too much. Yeah? Well, it's still, I'm still reducing dimensionality in the data. As in, I'm taking n by m dimensional data. I'm taking my m dimensional data points, and I'm going to replace them by a single dimension, which just says what cluster you belong to. So I'm going from m dimensions to one dimension, which says what is my cluster membership. And it's still unsupervised learning in the sense that we're just trying to discover structure in our data set. There's no particular classification problem we're trying to solve. Like, we don't have any labels associated with these data points. So I group this with PCA and with everything else because it's more of a feature generation strategy, right? You can, if you want to create a feature vector out of these points, I might describe each point in terms of what cluster it belongs to. And if I'm then trying to apply a learning algorithm, I'd think, well, points that belong to the same cluster probably behave similarly, so they have similar parameters. Whatever parameter is good at predicting, I don't know, whether you'll be friends with this person is going to be the same as the parameter for this person, roughly speaking. Yeah? So maybe I can capture the important properties of this data set with just one of four values for each node. Okay, so the idea then is to compactly describe the data in terms of these cluster memberships. So the input data is exactly the same as we had on Monday. We have this big matrix of features. It's in sort of an N by M matrix. And we would like to, that's our input. Our output would be this sort of compressed version of that feature matrix, like it was with PCA. So we'd like to output, for one, a list of cluster centroids, which is really just the, you know, the midpoint or the average of all of the nodes in one cluster. So that's just some, we went from an N by M data set to a K by M, all right? We're replacing N data points by K centroids. And the second thing we'd like is the cluster memberships, okay? So for each of these points, which of these centroids was it closest to? And these two pieces of information, the list of centroids and the cluster memberships, that is enough to approximately reconstruct our data. We can say, if I just replace every one of these points by its centroid, how much information was lost? In other words, how far was each point in the original data set away from the centroid? And yeah, we can use this to get something like a good feature representation down the line. Here we can just say, we'll use a binary indicator vector for every single point that says which of these four clusters do you belong to, and we can treat this as a feature vector for some other classification or regression task. And what we're implicitly assuming by doing so is we're assuming that nodes that belong to the same cluster are going to behave similarly in terms of whatever we're trying to train. Okay, so this is our basic problem setup. We have this N by M data matrix. We want to find these K by M centroids and this N-dimensional cluster assignment vector. So we're really compressing our data a lot. We're going from N by M real numbers to just N integers plus K by M real numbers. So we're saving a lot of hard disk space or something like that. And we'd like to choose these clusters and the cluster memberships so as to minimize again, like we did on Monday, this reconstruction error. So on Monday, what did this look like? We had our data points minus the compressed version of them with PCA. Right? So we said, if I throw away the last few dimensions, how much information do I lose compared to the original vector? Here we're saying, if I replace each point by one of these centroids, how far is it from the centroid? How much information do I lose? And I would like to choose my centroids, again, so that this reconstruction error is minimized. Okay, so can you solve this optimally? Not really. It's NP hard. This proof is surprisingly recent when I looked it up. I didn't realize this was not a known thing, yeah? Well, I mean, there are combinatorially many ways you can assign points to centroids, right? So just to give you sort of a very hand-wavy reason why this is an NP-hard problem, the number of possible solutions to this is, what is it, k to the power n, right? Any node could belong to any one of those centroids. So it's at least a combinatorially large space you're searching through to say what all of these centroids ought to be in order for us to find a good solution. So choosing the best possible centroids and centroid assignments, well, obviously it's a tough proof if it was done in 2009, but it turns out to be very hard. Of course, like pretty much everything in today's lecture, we're going to just solve it using a greedy algorithm, and we'll come to terms with that. So the greedy algorithm is very, very simple. We just initialize all of our clusters completely at random, however you like. And then for every single point, we want to say, okay, which of these clusters does it belong to? Just put it in the nearest one. And then step two, now we've got new cluster assignments, we can update our centroids. So we can just say, I'll replace each centroid by the means of all the points assigned to that centroid. And you can just iterate through this and see what you arrive at. So this was a homework exercise last quarter, so you can look through last quarter's homework if you're actually keen to implement this one for yourselves. There are two clustering algorithms I'll talk about today, so actually this quarter the other one is going to be the homework, but they're both fairly similar principles. Really the difficulty of implementing this thing is all of the nasty, nasty corner cases, like what do you do if you end up with a centroid that doesn't have any points assigned to it, right? You've got to randomly reinitialize it somewhere else. What do you do if you get two centroids that end up being exactly the same? You've got some tie you have to break somehow and randomly move one of them somewhere else. Things like that are what make this a little bit finickety to implement. And basically it gets you some locally optimal solution. It's going to converge to something slightly different every time you run this, but hopefully it's a pretty good proxy for minimizing this reconstruction error. Okay, that's k-means. You can go through the further reading later. I just wanted to get on to the next clustering algorithm. Yeah? Excellent question. It's coming up in like six slides. Because it comes up every time. All right, so we saw PCA, we saw k-means, we saw how k-means can address one limitation of PCA where the data is highly localized, even though there's no dimension with less variance than another. Here's another kind of data that, okay, PCA is still not going to work, but maybe k-means won't work so well for it either. So you can imagine running k-means on this data. Well, okay, you've got to pick k first. Imagine I chose k equal 3. Maybe I'd get something like this. Whereas if I chose, I don't know, k equal 12, I could get something like this. I think there's 12, right? So in this kind of data, we have something like clusters within clusters, which is what's called like hierarchical clusters. So you have sort of some level 1 small clusters and some level 2 big clusters, and you maybe would like to find that kind of low-dimensional structure in the data. I think this example or this picture seems like it's something I've really had to struggle to invent in a very unrealistic case. I think it's not, actually. I think you do see feature vectors that are somehow hierarchical in nature all the time in real applications. So you can imagine something like, let's build feature vectors out of your Facebook profile. Okay, you have your hometown, you have the town you live in now, you have the school you go to, you have the department you're in, so on and so forth. You have the classes you take. So those kinds of features turn out to be hierarchical in nature, right? Everyone who's in this class is, well, almost everyone is, you know, taking computer science. They all go to UCSD. They all live in San Diego. So you have this kind of specification or generalization of your features. That's what something like a Facebook profile is going to look like. That's a hierarchical feature vector, right? So what you'd like is some sort of dimensionality reduction algorithm that automatically discovers the hierarchical structure in features. So we'll find that there's some cluster which corresponds to San Diego, and within that there's a cluster that corresponds to UCSD or something like that. And if we can do that, this will give us a nice way of building a feature vector for each of our nodes, right? We can describe it not just in terms of what cluster does it belong to, but what cluster does it belong to at each level. So all of these nodes now have like a level 2 membership. And sorry for my handwriting, a level 1 membership. So the feature vector somehow describes every node's position in the hierarchy. And why this is useful is because it allows these two nodes, for instance, they can share some information, but not all information. So maybe they have something in common, even though they don't have the most specific things in common. So maybe these two nodes both live in San Diego, even though they don't both go to UCSD or something like that. And if you're training a predictor based on this kind of principle, they might be exactly what you want. You want to say, I can train a predictor based on generic characteristics, they'll help me somewhat. And as I go down and down and down, I have more specific characteristics. So this is saying, how much more likely am I to be friends with this person, given that they live in San Diego? And then this says, given that they live in San Diego, I'm more likely to be friends with them, given that they attend UCSD, something like that. So you just get more and more specific parameters as you climb down the hierarchy. Okay, so you're coming up with a representation that says points have some features in common, but not all features. And we want to come up with an algorithm that's going to do that for us, yeah? The distance between the nodes is exactly the principle we're going to use to come up with this algorithm. For the case of friendship, that's a pretty reasonable assumption. But yeah, if we're building a feature vector based on this principle, what we're going to be doing in a minute is we're going to be trying to assign points that have high proximity to the same cluster in some sense, which is what we're doing for k-means as well. So yeah, we are making an assumption there that points that are close to each other in this original feature space are going to behave similarly in terms of whatever predictive task we care about. If that assumption was not true, I guess you'd be in a little bit of trouble. It's a pretty safe assumption, though, I think. Nodes with similar features in the original feature space probably behave similarly for most well-posed predictive tasks. Okay, so here's the algorithm I'm going to use to find this hierarchy. It's, again, a very simple one. We're just going to say, initially, every single node is its own cluster, and we're going to gradually merge whichever two clusters are closest to each other. And when we merge them, we're going to replace a cluster by its centroid. So that's all that's in the pseudocode. Actually, this one is going to be the homework exercise this quarter. It's much, much more obvious if I just draw what's going on. Okay, so you can imagine we have some points, A, B, C, D, E,
I don't know.
F, G, H. Let's try and find the hierarchical structure amongst these points, right? So which two are closest? G, H. I think that's pretty unambiguous, all right? So we're going to combine those two, and we're going to come up with a new centroid in the middle of that cluster. And as we go, we can draw what gets combined with what when, okay? So we took G and H, we combine them into a single cluster, GH. All right, now what's closest? DE, probably. Do the same thing here. I guess AB. Okay, what now? ABC. All right, now we're combining a node with a cluster. It's going to look like this. We're going to have centroid over here. We haven't seen C yet, so let's put it over there. And we get A, B, C. What next? D, E, F, maybe. I don't know. I think it's hard to tell by eyeballing it. Any votes for ABC plus DEF? No. Any votes for GH plus DEF? No. Any votes for ABC plus GH? One. Okay. These two are the next closest. We'll combine those. What's that? ABC plus GH. Well, I don't really like that one, actually, because it's going to get in the way. But okay. A, B, C, G, H. There's only one thing left to do, which is combine everything. I guess this will have to, it'll have to cross. And we get, wait a minute, let's put it further down. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H. All right, eventually everything is combined. If I'd drawn this better, there wouldn't have to have been any crossings. What I get is this is tree, which kind of describes the hierarchical structure in terms of the order in which I combined these clusters. So really it really gives you these different levels I was talking about earlier. You have like level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, and level 5. So I can somehow describe my nodes in terms of their memberships to these clusters. Okay, so this gives us some kind of hierarchy. This type of tree happens to be called a dendrogram, and that gives you a nice way of representing or coming up with a feature vector that represents each of your original nodes in terms of its position in this hierarchy. So let's just say we want to take levels 1, 2, and 3. That would mean we might get a feature vector that's something like this. So we're going to, for each node, we're going to say, where does it belong in level 1? Where does it belong in level 2? Where does it belong in level 3? So does it belong to community 1 or 2 in level 1, 1 or 2 in level 2, 1 or 2 in level 3? That's just six binary questions. That gives us a six-dimensional feature vector to describe each node in some kind of hierarchical fashion so that nodes higher up in the hierarchy can share information with clusters lower down in the hierarchy, okay, which is kind of what we wanted. All right, that's it for clustering. So coming back to this question that was asked before, how do you choose the K and K-means? And we have the same question for everything else in the algorithm we just saw. How do we choose where to cut it? How do we choose what level of cluster is coarse-grained or fine-grained enough? With PCA, how many dimensions do we want to keep and how many do we want to discard? And later on today, we're doing community detection. How many communities do I want to find in the network? All reasonable questions. Like I've kind of said, there's two ways you can think about all of this dimensionality reduction stuff, right? You can think about it in terms of something like compression, and you can think about it in terms of building a good feature representation for some predictive task later. So maybe that's going to help to answer how many dimensions do you need? So if you're thinking about it as compression, well, the same kind of questions you would ask if you were trying to compress a video or something like that. It could just be a simpler question of how many dimensions you can actually afford, right? Maybe your data doesn't fit in memory if you keep too many dimensions. Maybe your algorithm just takes too long to run if you keep too many dimensions. So maybe that determines how many dimensions you can have. Otherwise, as with video compression as well, maybe there's just some point where adding dimensions doesn't really help anymore. Like, you want to choose that point where increasing the bit rate by a little bit increases the quality by a lot, but then beyond that, increasing the bit rate by a little bit doesn't do anything. It's kind of, you've reached an asymptote, so you might like to sort of look for this elbow in the data where, you know, below which adding dimensions helps a lot, after which adding dimensions doesn't help very much. So you could use some criterion to trade off how much does the MSE have to go down before I consider a dimension to be worth adding. Okay, that's the compression answer to the problem. The other answer is if you're thinking about it in terms of something like feature generation. So you want to use it later on for some predictive task. Then the only way to answer that question is to say, what k is best in a predictive capacity? So every value of k, every number of dimensions in PCA, or whatever you like, they all give you a different feature representation. So let's just find out which one works best. So let's say, you know, we have this usual trade-off between having expressive enough dimensions and not overfitting. So we'd like to find that sweet spot. Easiest way to do this is to pick some number of dimensions, get our feature representation, train our model, and see how well does it work on new data. You know? So if I took more PCA dimensions or higher K in K means, or I took all of the levels of hierarchical clustering, I'm going to represent the original data with higher and higher fidelity. So my training error is going to go down and down and down, like usual. But when I apply it to new data, I'm hopefully going to get this sweet spot, on one end of which my model wasn't expressive enough. I didn't actually capture the low-dimensional structure, or I didn't capture the original structure. And on the other hand, I overfit. Okay, so that's how you choose K, right? If you're thinking about this as a means of solving a predictive task later, pick whichever K is best for your task. Hopefully that thoroughly answers the question. Okay. All right, that's it for clustering. We still have plenty of time to cover everything I want in community detection, unless there's anything else there. Clustering? Happy with clustering? Great. All right. So let's move on to communities. So like I said, there are kind of these two paradigms. We have this notion of finding low-dimensional structure in feature vectors, and we have this idea of finding low-dimensional structure in networks. So far everything we've been doing has been looking at feature vectors. There's some kind of points embedded in this high-dimensional space. There's no real relationship between the points except whether they're close to each other or not. So we have PCA to do this. We have k-means clustering to do this. What we'd like instead is how can we find low-dimensional structure in data if the data is defined by the relationships between the instances rather than the feature vector or the position in space of the instances. So if you've got something like a social network, how might we find low-dimensional structure in this data, or how might we compactly represent all of the relationships in this graph? So this is my network of Facebook friends, which you'll get to know very intimately in the homework. It's not too large a network to deal with, thankfully. But all it is a bunch of relationships between nodes. Okay, I've plotted them on some 2D grid, but that's sort of artificial. That's just a way of visualizing it. All the information I really have here is this adjacency structure. And I'd like to somehow find some low-dimensional information there. Right? Maybe I'd like to split this up into my high school and my, I don't know, my hometown and my UCSD community or something. Something like that, all right? And this could be some good feature representation for some other predictive task. People who belong to the same communities probably behave similarly, so I can use their community memberships, as opposed to, say, cluster assignments, to solve some predictive task about them. So, you know, this is the example I gave in the previous lecture. Maybe we have not a social network, but this is a protein-protein interaction network. So an edge indicates that two proteins somehow interact with each other. This is a very different notion of something like a community, where nodes within communities don't really talk, but there are lots of edges across communities. So I think in this case, it's like these proteins regulate these proteins. So the regulators don't really interact. The proteins don't really interact, but the regulators interact with the proteins, something like that. But the point is, in this case, as with the last case, the community memberships essentially compress, or they explain, the structure of the graph. So I have this very high-dimensional adjacency matrix, but without losing much information, I can throw away the adjacency matrix and just replace every node by the community it belongs to. And then all I've got to keep is, okay, how do the communities interact with each other? So community B interacts with community D. It's very densely connected. Community A interacts with community C. And that's about it. If I just tell you which of these four communities every node belongs to in that interaction pattern, I can pretty much compress my adjacency matrix into just by describing each node as a four-dimensional vector of its community memberships. Okay, so yeah, we're going to see now a bunch of algorithms you can use to group or arrange points based on their connectivity. So yeah, I sort of call those clustering community detection. One is based on features and proximity. One is based on relationships or connectivity as defining similarity. These are slightly rough notions, I think. So if I took an adjacency matrix and I pretended that was a feature vector, am I doing community detection or clustering? I don't really know. But roughly speaking, these are the notions I have in my head of what these two things mean. Organizing things based on features or organizing things based on connectivity. Okay, so, you know, what is a community? We all belong to communities. What makes you consider some set of people or some set of things to be a community? I heard something. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, so interconnectivity, whatever that means. I guess you kind of said two things there. One is that within the community, people should be connected. The other is that outside of the community, or there shouldn't be too many connections that leave the community. They should be somewhat insular. So, I don't know, insularity, if that's, is that a word? I can't write it down, so maybe it's not a word. Insularity. Anything else? Yeah. Common features is a great answer, but that's what I'm going to call a cluster. So, how can you come up with the definition of a community that only depends on connectivity and doesn't depend on features? I don't know. I think the first definition here is actually pretty expressive. It almost captures everything. The list I came up with, which is capturing roughly the same notions, is the following. One, people should be connected to each other. Two, maybe two and four simultaneously. There should be a lot of edges in communities, and there should be not many edges crossing communities. So maybe they should be adversarial, or they should just not know each other too well. And, I mean, three is maybe the more colloquial definition, which is just saying, if you want to consider a set of people to be a community, they should probably be a bit cliquey. They should interact a lot with each other and not interact too much with the outside world. So, I don't know, maybe these are four versions of the same thing, but we're going to kind of see a bunch of algorithms that try to find communities by just altering this definition very slightly. So one is to say, can I find sets of nodes that are connected? Can I find sets of nodes where there's very many edges in the community and few edges across communities? Can I find something like cliques, which might be allowed to overlap, so they're not necessarily adversarial groups, just cliques of people who talk to each other? And the fourth is some sort of probabilistic version of this, where you want density inside and sparsity outside of a community. Okay, so one, connector components, we're just going to say which nodes are reachable from which other nodes. We need some definition to do this. The definition is wordy, but it's a pretty intuitive notion. We say, essentially, a component of a network is connected if, for every pair of nodes A and B, A is reachable from B, and B is reachable from A. That's what's called strongly connected. This is from Facebook. It's an undirected graph. So obviously, if things are reachable in one direction, they're reachable in the other. There's a weaker notion, which we'll probably see when we come back to social networks in a few weeks' time, which allows that information might only flow in one direction. So A is reachable from B, or B is reachable from A. It only matters for directed networks, of course. But, you know, in the case of this network, it's just going to give us three communities, whatever those are. They're going to look like this, this, and this. Not so unreasonable, right? That's about the roughest notion of a community you could come up with. So, anything we don't like about that definition? Yeah, and I guess basically it's incredibly fragile is the problem, right? So if you have two connector components, as soon as there's one connection between them, they're going to become one connected component because that one connection forms a bridge that connects everybody. And, you know, as you know from real-world social networks, everybody is reachable from everybody else. I think LinkedIn even tells you how far away they are, right? So if you were to run this algorithm on any realistic network, you're just going to get a blob containing everything, which is called a giant component. So we'll come back to this a bit more in the social networks lecture, but there are sort of structural reasons in realistic graphs why you're always going to have this one giant blob, why, you know, everyone tends to be reachable from everyone else. And that sort of breaks this very, very loose notion of communities from being a sensible one. It's okay for a tiny little ego network like the one I showed, but for the whole Facebook graph, it's not going to do much. So, you know, here's another network which looks somewhat community-like. It only has one connected component, though. So this is Zachary's Karate Club. Who's seen it before? Oh, good. Almost nobody. So this is a network that was collected in 1970 by Zachary. Zachary is not in the Karate Club. Zachary does not do karate. Zachary does social science, and he interviewed all the members of the karate club to say, who else in this karate club do you have a social connection with? And the interesting thing that made this so ripe for anthropological study is that, you know, you have this one very central figure, the karate instructor, and this other central figure, the club president, and almost everyone interacts with one of them, but they don't like each other, and the people who like the instructor tend not to like the club president and vice versa. So somehow this club is in danger. It's forming factions or something like that. And we might like to automatically find where those factions or where those communities are, but we need some looser definition than what connected components give us. Because, you know, somewhere there's these people in the middle, I don't know, maybe these people who are sort of interlopers between the club president and the instructor. When the club splits, we don't know where they're going to go, but somehow we'd like to at least find the high-level attributes that says who are we certain is going to go in which direction. Okay, so just to convince you, this network is a very, very popular one. There is this Zachary's Karate Club. So to become a member of this club, you have to be the first person to use Zachary's Karate Club in an academic paper for a certain conference. Okay? So many of the luminaries of network science, this is this is Mark Newman, this is YY Ahn, this is, I think, Mason Porter. You know, you get this, you become a member of the club, you get this karate club trophy. I am not a member, I'm afraid to say. But hopefully that convinces you that this particular network has been studied maybe a little bit too much. Anyway, so what do we want to do? We want to cut this network into two partitions that are going to roughly correspond to the factions in this club. And our idea is maybe we'd like something like a cut. We'd like to say, well, I know that there's not going to be not very much communication between the two factions, so can I split this graph into two halves such that very little information or very little connections flow across the two halves. So, you know, I want to choose this cut that minimizes the number of edges crossing the cut. Yeah? Well, I mean, you can do that. And what do you get? This is the optimal cut in that network. It's not very exciting, right? So I want as few nodes as possible, so I want as few edges as possible to cross the cut. This has no edges crossing the cut whatsoever. That's the best solution. I mean, that just sort of seems stupidly degenerate, of course, but I mean, if I fix that degeneracy and say, well, the set should not be empty, I'm still going to just get this solution, which has a cut of size 1. It's still sort of uselessly imbalanced, though. So somehow I need to more loosely fix this notion of degeneracy. I want to say, well, I want to somehow have these clusters being balanced. I want them to be about the same size, because I know that for a community to be a meaningful construct, it should at least have many people in it. So if I want to split the network into two parts, I'd like them to be roughly the same size. So this is our first sort of real community detection algorithm, ratio cuts. We have some set of communities. I think in all the examples I'll talk about now, there's going to be just two communities. So really we're trying to separate some set of nodes from the negation of that set of, or the complement of that set of nodes. And we'd like, as in the previous expression, we'd like the cut to be small. So we'd like there to be not too many edges that are crossing between the two factions. What we're adding to this, which wasn't in the previous sort of graph cuts version, is that we'd like the communities to be reasonably sized. So we want this term to be small, and we want this term to be large in order to minimize the final expression. So we want few edges crossing the cut, but relatively large communities. Okay, so we can run that on this same graph. You know, this orange solution, which we would think is not a very good one. We have two communities, which is why the 1 on 2 is there. The numerator is for each community how large is the cut, so it's always the same value when there's just two. So there's three edges crossing the divide. There's 34 nodes in total. One of them, the communities, has just one node. One of them has 33. That corresponds to this ratio cut cost. Now, the sort of reasonable partition that we'd come up with looks much better. So we've got a much larger numerator. There's now 9 edges across the cut, but we have relatively balanced communities. So it has a much lower cost. Things are looking pretty good, right? Yeah? Yeah, I mean, you could imagine this is some sort of centrality-type problem. So you could imagine casting your goal as one of saying, who are the central figures in this graph? I mean, these two have the highest page rank or something. I think in this case that's reasonable. But generally for communities, there need not be central figures, right? There could be two factions, neither of which have a single leader. And then a centrality-based approach is not going to be so sensible. But we really want communities. Okay, yeah, in this case, maybe that would work just fine. But generally speaking, we're not really considering the leader of the groups, just the difference between the communities. Okay, so I hear a murmur. People have found the problem with this algorithm, right? So, yeah, there it is. So what is the cost of this cut going to be? So now we've only got one edge crossing the cut. And, yeah, we have... one much larger denominator, but the cut is so small that this is actually the cheapest possible solution in terms of that ratio cut cost. So this is the cut we would choose. It's still pretty degenerate, I think. Not a good solution, right? Does anyone want to advocate for this solution? I mean, I'd say it's realistic in some sense. If I say, what are the two factions in this community? No, this is a terrible solution. This person is not a faction. But if I said, how is the karate club going to split? Then, oh, maybe the person with no friends will leave. You know, so it's maybe not the solution we were looking for, but in terms of how the graph is going to split, it's maybe the correct one. Okay? Still, we'd like to fix it. So the problem was we don't want to consider that node too highly, precisely because they have no friends except the instructor in the karate club. So rather than saying, I'd like to find communities that are equally sized, I might want to say something like, can I find communities that are equally influential? So it's not just important how many members are in the community, but it's important how many friends the members have, right? So to do that, I'd replace the previous expression, which was just the number of nodes in the community, with an expression which is the sum of degrees in the community. This is now counting for every node of the community, how many connections does that node have? So it's some measure of the importance or total influence or something like that in the community. And that's another algorithm called normalized cuts. Yeah? Yeah, there'll be two elements in the summation. If it's only if you're only cutting it in two, the numerator is going to be the same in both expressions. So really all that you're measuring in the denominator is the imbalance between the two communities. I mean, this is what it looks like when there's two terms. It's still how much does this community separate these people from everyone else? How much does this community separate these people from everyone else? Okay, so yeah, normalized cut. Things are looking much better now. This solution, okay, still has about the same costs. You have a cost of one for the tiny community, but you have a sort of negligible cost for everything else because that's where all of the influence is, so that's sort of badly, I don't know, it's badly balanced in some sense. The black solution, the one we kind of wanted, now looks a lot better. So the cut is still of cost nine. And, well, I mean, you can add them up in your own time, but there's sort of 76 and 80 edge endpoints in each of these communities, right? So there's 76 outgoing links, whether they stay in the community or not. You're adding up the degree. And there, this is, I think, the best solution in the entire graph. So just to convince you of the ubiquity of the karate club, this is how you do it in Python. You import network X, and you say networkx.karateclubgraph. So these examples are really, really easy to come up with in Python. Karate Club has been done to death. Okay. So this is how I've generated those numbers, 76 and 80. I just said, okay, there's this set of nodes, there's this set of nodes. I'll add up their 2 degrees. It's a very good library if you're looking for something very lightweight to do simple network analysis, and also all the visualization was done with it too. Okay, so just to end this section with a bit of a history lesson, what actually happened to Zachary's Karate Club. Here's the normalized cut that we identified as being the cheapest, and red and blue is what actually happened. So the blue people sided with the instructor, the red people sided with the club president. So we basically got it right, okay? There's this node number 9 is some kind of anomaly. They went the where we might not have expected them to, which is kind of a shame, because otherwise people would have stopped talking about this network as soon as normalized cuts were invented, instead of writing papers that get this one node correct. Okay, so that's one sort of set of algorithms for community detection. We're trying to separate nodes into these disjoint, or at least almost disjoint groups. Which is okay, it's useful for factional karate clubs. It's useful as well for other factional things, right? This is a network of conservative and progressive political bloggers and the link structure between them. So, in this type of network, you'll see high interconnectivity between people on the same side of political spectrum, but relatively few links between them. Okay, this is the setting for which the type of community detection algorithm we've just seen is very appropriate. And apparently for karate clubs too. But real social networks, like your network of friends, is hopefully not like this, right? Your network of friends is not just dying to split in two. It's hopefully a bit more cooperative and less adversarial than something like this karate club or something like a political blog. And maybe you'd like some notion of communities that can capture this, I don't know what it is, this cooperative structure, which is not just looking for cuts in the graph, but is looking for some other notion of communities. So what could happen in a Facebook graph? Well, what happens in my Facebook graph? Yes, you have some disjoint communities. You know, this set of people doesn't know this set of people. Once upon a time, I didn't live in the United States, so most of my US friends do not know my Australian friends. They're not really enemies, but they're just disjoint sets in the network. Of course, you also see overlaps. So my girlfriend's friends and my friends. These are partially overlapping sets. That's how they should be, right? You know, if they're exactly the same set of people, you got a problem. If they're totally disjoint, you've got a different problem. And finally, you can have nested structure as well. So this I gave back when we were talking about hierarchical clustering. You have my American friends, my San Diego friends, my UCSD friends, my UCSD CS friends, so on and so forth. So you have smaller and smaller communities that nest within each other and are presumably more and more cliquey as they nest more. So we'd like to come up with some notion of community detection that can handle these different types of maybe more cooperative behavior. So I'll just give one example, which is called clique percolation, that looks for sort of cliquey communities. So what this does is it searches for cliques of some fixed size. That's a parameter to the algorithm, k. You remember what a clique of size k is in a graph. It's just the complete graph. This would be K4, right? So we'll say, this is some community, or this is some micro community. And all we do is we say, I'm going to look for every instance of this, I'm going to call those my initial communities, and then I'll say, if two communities share K-1 nodes, so in this case, 3 nodes in common, then I'm going to merge them into a single community, and I'm going to repeat this until no more merging takes place. So that's why it's called percolation. You kind of just gradually expanding or growing these little communities by one node at a time until it sort of covers the whole graph or until it stops. I've sort of just drawn this all over my pseudocode. That's basically what's going on. We just say, while there are two communities that have a K-1 clique in common, merge them. Run this until you can't do it anymore. So we can do this for K=3 on a simple graph. What do I want to have here? A, B, C, D, E. They can all be connected if you like. F. What's going to be interesting? G, H. Okay, that'll do, I think. So how do we start? We start by finding all the 3 cliques. Those are our initial communities. We have A, B, C, E, G, H, and then we have 4 cliques within K4, the B, C, D, and E. We have B, C, D, B, C, E, B, D, E, and C, D, E. Right, so those are our initial communities. What we're going to just do is, while there exist 2 communities with a 2 clique, or just an edge in common, we'll merge them. So, I don't know, things will happen pretty quickly. So CDE has nodes in common with BDE, cross one of them out, add C. So BCE has the same nodes in common. BCD has the same nodes in common. What else? And then, of course, ABC has B and C in common, so we'll merge that too. What does that give us? No more progress is possible. We get two communities, one with five nodes, one with three. Yes? Yeah. I mean, I guess this is something like a generalized connected components algorithm. Well, it doesn't matter if some nodes in the community don't have K4, as long as they're part of another set that has K4 somewhere. So it is not, I think maybe it's not quite as strict as you're worried about. Like, it just has to be, it doesn't have to be that everyone in a community is totally connected. It just, everyone has to be part of a K4 graph somewhere amongst all the other members. Anyway, I mean, this is sort of, it is maybe too strict a notion. This is basically a generalization of connected components. So if you run clique percolation for k equals 2, it is connected components. If you run it for k equals 3, well, it's connected components, but the path between nodes has to somehow, well, there has to be a path of triangles, all of which share edges, right? So, yeah, it's kind of looking for some stronger connectivity structure. It's not my favorite algorithm in the world. I mean, it's not what I'd really call data mining in the sense that we just invented some definition out of our head and decided that's what we're going to look for as communities. It's not super principled, but it does at least allow you to get communities that are both disjoint and partially overlapping. Okay, that's the main event. Do we have time for one more? We sure do. Okay, great. So, one last community detection model. So, what we'd like to do is we've had all these models that depended on somewhat ad hoc definitions. We said, out of some kind of common sense or intuition, what do we think a community looks like? And then we looked for some cut or some cliques or whatever that satisfied that definition. What we'd like to do finally is to describe some probabilistic model of what communities might look like. So this is going to be useful if we want to do things like hypothesis tests. If we have some set of communities or some graph, can we say whether this graph is more community-like than some other graph? Can we say that Twitter is more community-like than Facebook or vice versa or something? And for that, we'd like some richer notion, some probabilistic notion perhaps, of whether a particular network is community-like or not, so that we can evaluate the likelihood of observing a particular set of communities compared to some null model. Yeah? Yeah. That's what I would love to do. I think that's a great problem. I think it's a very hard one because in practice, there's very little data out there where you've had people label what the gold standard communities are, right? Like with all these unsupervised algorithms, we have no one telling us whether the communities we got are right or wrong. Okay, with Zachary's Karate Club, we could see what happened. But generally speaking, the best we can do is to say, did we model the network well? And good communities are ones that form a good model for the network. Now, the problem you mentioned is a problem I love. If you can think of good data to study it with, I think it's a fantastic one. But yeah, what you do need then is some large data set of many, many networks, each of which has gold standard labeled communities so that you could turn this into a supervised learning problem. But I think in general that's really hard. So usually community detection is not cast that way. It's just cast as capturing the underlying low-dimensional structure in a network. And we only care about whether we can reproduce the network as a measure of saying whether our communities are good. Okay, so What we'd like now is some null model of what, I guess, communities wouldn't look like. And we'd like to say, does the community structure, or what we believe to be the community structure in this network, deviate from a null model or not? So the simplest null model is something like an Erdős-Rényi random model. It's got a funny name, but it's not very much. You have some network, and it just says edges form independently at random, or with the same probability. So you fix your network density, and you just shove that many edges into the graph. Okay, so there's no community structure in such a network. There's no preference for nodes to connect to other members of the community, or whatever you think a community might be, than there is for them to connect outside of the community. So that's the null model you'd like to compare to. You'd like to say, does a real graph exhibit this type of structure, or does it somehow deviate from this null model? In other words, does it exhibit some structure that's more community-like? So that's what this measure is trying to capture. This is called the network modularity. So it's trying to say, what is the separation between what we actually observed and this basic null model? So this basic null model is saying edges don't form within communities. They just form totally at random, ignoring the community structure. So the probability then that you would get the probability that you'll get an edge in the community is just the probability that the first node belongs to the community multiplied by the probability that the second node belongs to the community, nothing else. And we compare that to what we actually observed, which says in the real graph, what fraction of edges were inside the community. And then we just measure the separation between these two things. So maybe it becomes more obvious if you look at some real graphs, or at least the two extreme cases. In one case, you have a graph which is totally community-like, and you can compute these two values. So EKK is saying, what fraction of edges appear within this community? Half of them do. And AK is saying, what fraction of endpoints appear in this community? Okay, again, it's half. It's not very interesting yet. And then Q is going to be equal to 2 times a half minus a quarter is equal to a half. Okay, that's one case. To make it a bit more obvious, here's another one. This is the least community-like graph you can possibly come up with. So edges never form inside communities. They always form across communities, which maybe is what you actually have if it's a protein-protein interaction network or something like that, where these are some set of proteins and they're regulators. Then you'd have EKK is equal to 0. There are no edges inside the community, even though half of the endpoints are. And that gives you Q equals 2 times 0 minus a quarter. What's that equal to? Negative a half, I guess. All right, so at the end of the day, this gives you a measure of how community-like is some particular set of communities in a graph. On the sort of extreme negative end, you're saying it's much less community-like than even a randomly organized pair of edges would be. On the other end, you're saying it's much more community-like than a random set of edges would be. I guess I just showed you the example that is the least community-like. The one that is the most community-like is sort of a limiting case. If you have just loads and loads of tiny communities, and they're all totally dense. Okay, there's 8 communities in that case. Then Q is going to be equal to 8 times 1 on 8 minus 1 on 8 squared, which approaches 1 as K approaches infinity. Okay, so it's almost it. That gives us some measure of whether a particular set of communities is more community-like than would be a random organization of all of the edges. If we want to turn this into a community detection algorithm, all we've got to do is say, can we find the set of communities that is most community-like according to this definition? So in other words, that maximizes the fraction of edges inside the community, minimizes the fraction of edges that are crossing the communities. It's a very natural definition of what communities should look like, and this gives us a measure that we can optimize. We can try and maximize this value Q, we we could try and choose the communities that maximize Q. Turns out to be, again, some NP-hard problems where I have to approximate it. Yeah? Why we use squared? So this is just saying in the null model, what are the probability that an edge is in a community? It's the probability that the first endpoint is in the community and the probability the second endpoint is in the community. And under the null model, those are independent. So it's the same probability squared. Okay, anyway, it's NP hard, but there's a simple solution to this, which is similar to what you'll implement for the homework, not for this algorithm, but for a different one, which is just greedily optimizing community detection. Okay, so a very simple way people optimize a lot of community detection algorithms because they're invariably NP hard, as they're sort of combinatorial problems to assign every node to some arbitrary subset of the communities. Is you just pick some random community membership and you say for each step, how can I assign a node to a different community so as to maximize this quantity? And you just keep doing single moves like that, each of which is going to increase Q by a tiny bit until no further improvement is possible. And that's sort of the local search or the greedy solution to choosing communities according to that definition that says edges should be inside, non-edges should be out. Outside communities. Okay, so that's about it. Just quickly summarize. We've seen today community detection algorithms based on basically these four principles, different definitions of what a community should be, motivate different algorithms. Finally, homework two. It's available. It takes a bit longer than the first homework. I don't think it's much harder, but it involves a lot more coding. So make sure you get started on it. Somebody asked if they can do it in pairs.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.